Welcome to Soda City Unleashed, a podcast where we decode pet health with some of the best vets in Columbia, South Carolina. I'm your host, Emily White, and today I have boarded veterinary internist, Dr. Alex Gallagher, with us. How are you, Dr. Gallagher?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Emily. How are you today?
I am wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for asking. Tell us about yourself.
Well, I've been in veterinary medicine for about 35 years now. I actually started at the young age of 15 working in vet clinics, but actually had no intention of being a veterinarian.
Really? You didn't have that aha moment like everyone else?
I did not. You know, a lot of people, you talk to them like, oh, since time I was three or four, my older brother's a vet. That's how I got into this industry. Oh. He always wanted to be a vet, and I thought he's going to be the vet in the family. I actually started college as an aerospace engineer at Georgia Tech.
All right.
And had been working in clinics for a few years before I went to college. And, you know, sometimes life throws curveballs at you and you end up backing up and going down a different path on the road. And so backed up and ended up going down the veterinary medicine trail. So followed a little bit in my brother's footsteps, graduated from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine in 2001. Did an internship, then went out to general practice for a couple of years, which is, again, another alternative track for people who go on to specialize. Most people know what they want to do.
Right.
They just go forward. I like to make it more difficult and challenging. And so spent a couple of years in general practice, and really that's when I really developed an interest in internal medicine and really dealing with the tougher cases and the hard to figure out, and decided to go back and do actually a second internship because I'm glutton for punishment. And eventually went back and did a residency after that. And then was fortunate to land back at my alma mater, actually, as a faculty member. And was at University of Florida for about 14 years as a hospital internist, as well as a faculty member teaching veterinary students in the classroom as well as in the hospital. And after 14 years, was looking to make a move and get a little closer to family that's up in this area. And so decided to move up here to Columbia, South Carolina, and join CVETS in about September of 2022.
Okay, awesome. So when you did your residency in internal medicine, did you ever practice before going back and joining faculty of the University of Florida, or did you go straight from your residency back to the university?
Yeah, great question. No, I went straight from residency when I finished there to practicing at University of Florida as a faculty member there.
So you were practicing and teaching.
Correct.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so there, as with many faculty programs, we spend a certain amount of the year on clinics doing clinical teaching, and then we have a certain part of our year that we are, quote-unquote, off clinics, which really just means you have a slightly more time to get some of the didactic things done, the teaching done, but a lot of times you're still working with your clients and following up on cases and things of that nature.
Interesting. Okay, so I have to ask, when you were a little kid and they asked you what you wanted to be when you grew up, what did you say?
I probably went through a lot of things. Top Gun came out. I was dead set I was going to be Tom Cruise and be Maverick and be a fighter pilot. I
There's
had pictures
time.
Of airplanes on my wall. Then as I got into high school and I realized a little bit more what you require to get into like the Naval Academy, I was like, maybe that's not quite for me. I did take a Army ROTC scholarship when I started at Georgia Tech.
Oh, wow.
Originally. So I guess I pseudo went down a short path of the military. But as I said, you know, life changes and things, and decided to drop that scholarship, move back home, and then go back to the University of Florida.
Interesting. Did you grow up in Florida?
I did, in Tampa.
Okay, very cool. Does your brother still practice?
He just recently retired. He owned two practices, so one of them he just sold to one of the other veterinarians that was working there, and he's still managing his other practice, but he's kind of stepped away from clinical practice at this point. And we're actually talking last night, he's trying to figure out what to do with his schedule now, because this is literally just in the last month he's retired, and now he has all this free time, he doesn't know what to do with himself.
Right. Goals. I mean, that's where you want to be, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Retired in quotation marks. Love it. Let's get into some of the health stuff. This is the question I've been asking everyone that's been on the show. What are your top three pieces of advice for pet owners?
I'd say my top three. Now, this comes from being an internist. Not,
sure.
I'm sure a general practitioner probably would have some other things. I think as an internist, top three things I want people to know is, you know, be aware of what's normal for your pet and be tuned in. And we have a lot of great owners that are really tuned into their pet, and they come in and, you know, they tell me about what's going on. And I always hear you probably, I'm sure you don't believe me, but I know my dog. And actually those people, I definitely take it to heart. I know my own dogs. I know when they're just not quite doing their thing. And sometimes that's real hard to put a finger on, right? But owners know their animals. And I always tell those people, you know, let me know what you think. Or, you know, even if you think it's not anything, mm-hmm. you know, be upfront. Let me know what you think's going on with your pet, you know. And so I think that's number one, is just being in tune with your pet and relaying those things, even if you think they're kind of trivial. We don't mm-hmm. have to go real in depth on everything, but letting me know what those things are, because a lot of times those are some of the first signs that there is an impending disease process going on with your pet. So I think that's number one. Number two, be cautious of Dr. Google. I'll say.
Good one.
While, you know, these days the internet's bustling with things, just like on the human side of medicine, there are some websites that have really great and accurate information. There's also equally as number of websites and other media that do not have accurate things. So I would tell owners, you know, I'm not afraid of owners going, doing some research on their own. Don't be afraid to bring some of that or ask questions about it. But also understand when we're skeptical about some of the things based on the resources that those come from. So tip number two, be cautious about the internet. Don't stay away from it. I would never tell owners don't go look at things. I've had owners find interesting things on the internet I wasn't aware of, and that's helped me help them. But just be, you know, take it a little bit with a grain of salt and realize that there's a lot of different things out there.
The AI stuff now, mm-hmm. I know if you Google anything, the first answer is an AI answer, and you have to be diligent and double check that, because, I mean, it's not a human giving you that, you know?
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. Number three tip for owners, I'd say remember that your veterinarian is always trying to do what they think is in the best interest of you and your pet. I know sometimes owners can feel like veterinarians are just trying to sell them something or push a bag of food or things, but majority of the time we're coming at that from, you know, a good place, and we're trying to do in that instance what's best. When clients come to me, a lot of times they ask me questions, well, should my vet have done X, Y, or Z? And a lot of times, well, at that moment in time, sure, that was a great thing to do. I may be telling you something different because now I have the last 6 months of your vet has tried to exclude a lot of different things and help you in a lot of ways. And that now helps me help you, having all that history, because now I don't have to go back, recheck some of those things, or I can now tell that we need to go in a different path at this right. point in time. So I think a lot of things, and this kind of goes back to the Dr. Google, a lot of people read things on the internet and get opinions from people on the internet. And if those opinions are against what their vet's recommended, they just assume their vet's
right.
the incorrect person mm-hmm. in that. And just have trust in your vet. They've spent a lot of time doing a lot of training and schooling and have a lot of practical experience in most cases. And again, we're all trying to work to help you and help your pet.
Absolutely. You guys wouldn't be in the position that you're in unless you were there to help the animals and the humans, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great advice. Tell us about some of the things you see every day in the internal medicine department.
I tell you, a lot of our everyday stuff is vomiting, diarrhea, and coughing. those are pretty common problems. And if we look at what gets published in the industry from the insurance companies, the pet insurance companies, and that's one of the information databases that they've been able to provide to us, or what are the common things pets are being seen for? Skin stuff, ears, itchy skin is a big one. As an internist, I don't do that. It's actually one of the reasons I left general practice, was not to do skin anymore. That was one of the things that pushed me back into doing an internal medicine residency. But GI things, that's a big issue. You know, and we see a lot of that. Most time I'm seeing it once it's become a chronic issue. But vomiting, diarrhea, and I'd say coughing, that's another big common thing that we see.
And you have to, I mean, narrow down. It could be anything, you know, a common side effects of anything in medicine is vomiting, diarrhea, maybe mm-hmm. coughing. So it's your job to kind of like assess, okay, you're now here with me because you've been doing this. Now we got to figure out what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. That's no easy feat.
It's challenging, you know, and obviously the pet can't tell us what's going on or why certain things, and they're not confessing about what they got into in the yard. And owners always swear my dog doesn't get anything. I watch them like a hawk and stuff. And while I have no doubt they do, dogs in particular are quick. And I always tell owners about my own personal dog that I had. Flynn was this rather large 90-pound lab. He was just a big lab dog. And one night I took him for a walk around the apartment complex I was living in, and literally his head went under a bush for less than 2 seconds. It went in, it came out. We walked for another 10 minutes. No idea anything's going on. I get back to the apartment. I turn him loose off the leash. He goes, lays down in the living room area, which I can see from the kitchen. That's usually what he does. But he's laying with his back away from me, which is unusual because usually when I'm in the kitchen, he's got an eye on me when I know, am I going to get a treat? Am I going to get a food or things? And he was just acting kind of a little bit odd and just staring off in the other direction. So I kept calling. I was like, Flynn, what's going on? I went to check on him and I went to look him in the face, and he's turning his head away from me and things. I'm like, what do you have? So I finally, I grab a hold of his face and I prop open his mouth, and he's got a slice of cheese pizza. And we're not talking a small piece of cheese pizza. This is, and if you peel anybody who's been around Gainesville, there's Five-Star Pizza and they make this super extra large pizza. And the thing's no joke like this. And he had it folded up and wadded in his mouth. And he'd been carrying it around for 10 minutes. He had snagged it under that bush. That's the only time his head went out of my field of view. For 2 seconds or less. He snagged that piece of pizza, carried it around for 10 minutes till we got back home. And he was just waiting for me to not to look so he could drop it, chew it up, and eat
it. So he was just holding it.
He was just holding it, right? So, you know, owners always say, my dog couldn't possibly get anything. As veterinarians, we go, okay, that's, you know, at least we don't know of anything. It doesn't rule it out, though.
Right.
And as I say, we try to get them to tell us, but they're not talking.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. They're good secret keepers.
Absolutely.
So just kind of going into that a little bit more, like what are some things that you would do to say, okay, I have a dog here. I know that it's had chronic diarrhea for the past week. I know this, this, and this. Like, here's the next step, because everything's inside of the mm-hmm. animal, right? Like those are the, and you can't just slice them open and look. Like what are things that you guys do in your department to try and figure out what's going on?
So there's a lot of different tools we use. You know, our history and physical exam take us a vast majority of the distance with GI disease, trying to sort through what our possibilities are. We then can use various types of imaging. So that may be x-rays, we call radiographs. It may be abdominal ultrasound. That allows us to view a little bit more of what's going on with the GI tract. Sometimes that gives us some information to go on. Sometimes that's relatively normal, which sometimes is good news, because mm-hmm. hopefully that means we're not dealing with something more severe or drastic going on with the GI tract. We may use endoscopy, which is basically a long tube with a camera on it. It's got a little channel in it, and we can pass that either down through the mouth into the stomach and first part of the small intestine to take a look at things, get biopsies from there. And sometimes those biopsies allow us then to make a definitive diagnosis. We can do colonoscopies. It's like people get going from the other end, and we can get in there into the colon and sometimes into the end of the small intestine and take a look and get biopsies from there. A lot of what we end up doing with some of these cases is sometimes just trials of different diets, probiotics, prebiotics, things of that nature. Because a lot of these disease processes, in about 60-70% of dogs and cats, chronic vomiting, diarrhea is oftentimes related to some sort of food responsive disease. So a lot of it is playing with different diets, see what works best for that patient.
Interesting. So, I mean, a lot of trial and error too with you guys. It's like a long road. It's not necessarily a quick fix.
It's definitely a long road. And a lot of owners, it's hard for them. They come, they've maybe been dealing with this for a few months, maybe 6 months, sometimes even years of chronic vomiting and diarrhea. And just as much as I'd like to give every pet that comes in a quick fix, a lot of times these chronic GI cases aren't a quick fix, or they'd already be better by the time they come to us. So it is a bit of trial and error, trialing things. Sometimes we have to do a trial for 2 or 4 weeks to see if we're going to get a response or not. And if not, then it's moving on to plan B, plan C, plan D.
That takes a special kind of person to be able to, I feel like with an ER case or, you know, a primary, you're finding something, fixing it, moving on. You kind of have to put in the work of like, okay, it's deeper than this. Like, we really have to figure it out. You're challenging yourself, I would assume, every day.
It is. You know, it's a lot of challenge. And while, you know, some of the diseases we deal with, we can do a test and say yes or no, the patient has this disease. You know, with some things like GI disease, again, we can do imaging, we can do biopsies. And that may get me as far as saying, okay, there's inflammation in the GI tract, but it doesn't tell me specifically what's causing that. And so it is a lot of investigative work and things. I always say veterinary internists were kind of like the Dr. House of veterinary medicine, if you remember that show. Mm-hmm. And so it is a lot of coming up with what you think's the most likely things, but then we just have to a lot of times try treating for that, see if it's getting better, because we don't have a specific test to go, well, your pet needs this diet or this medication for their diarrhea.
Right. Interesting. Well, I know something that you guys deal with a lot are urinary tract issues and interventions. Can you tell us a little bit about what you commonly see in that realm of things?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of different types of urinary disease out there. And when we talk about urinary disease or the urinary tract, we probably want to be a little specific about, well, what organs are we exactly talking about? So we have the kidneys. I'm going to get two of those. Each kidney has a ureter, which is a tube that connects the kidney down to the bladder. We obviously have the bladder. It stores our urine. And then we have the urethra, which is our tube that takes the urine to the outside world from the bladder. And common disease of the urinary tract we deal with, certainly chronic kidney disease and acute kidney disease where we've had an injury to the kidneys, we deal with a fair bit. We have urinary tract infections we commonly see, and urinary incontinence is probably another somewhat common problem that we deal with.
That means they can't.
That means they can't hold their urine properly for some reason. They're basically dribbling urine without realizing that they're leaking. So those are some of the common things we deal with. I like to deal with a bit more advanced cases that require what we term interventional procedures. Interventional procedures use some sort of imaging technique to allow us to, in a minimally invasive way, deal with conditions of the urinary tract that come up. And some of these conditions are a little bit by being a veterinary plumber, because we're dealing with obstruction of the plumbing somewhere, whether that's the ureters or the bladder or the urethra, where urine can't make it from the kidney down to the bladder into the outside world. So we do what I call kind of some replumbing in there to fix things. Some of it is dealing with congenital abnormalities that can lead to things like incontinence. So there's a condition called an ectopic ureter, where instead of that urine coming down, attaching to the bladder and dumping urine into the bladder, it actually tunnels through the bladder wall down into the urethra, and the opening's actually in the urethra.
Hmm.
And so since the urine's all just dumping into the urethra, there's nowhere to hold it.
Oh.
It just dribbles out. So we see a lot of young patients that have that. And so we have some minimally invasive procedures where in the past that was an open surgery, go in, open the bladder, mess with the ureter and things. Now we can do it all endoscopically. So long camera, a little bit like we talked about with GI disease, a little bit different type of scope, but we're able to go up the urethra, identify that, and then use a laser to actually move the opening of the ureter back into the bladder.
Wow.
And we can do that on an outpatient basis.
So that means?
Same day surgery. So we can come in, anesthetize them, do the procedure, wake them up, they go home, totally fine. There's no incision, nothing that has to be watched after. They don't have to be kept on cage rest or anything like that. None of the funny lampshade e-collars to wear. So it's a really nice technique for those patients.
That's a perk of a minimally invasive surgery.
That's when we talk about minimally invasive surgeries in general, there's a few things that we're looking to accomplish with that. One is, can we do it in a method that creates less pain for that patient? Can we do it in a manner that improves healing or shortens the recovery time on it? And in some cases, it's a matter of providing a procedure that allows us to correct or diagnose a problem when there's actually not any other option for it, or at least an option that has a good outcome for it. So those, when we come to minimally invasive procedures, those are the things that we're hoping that that procedure provides for us. At least one of those things. Sometimes it's majority of those that we're able to accomplish by doing those minimally invasive procedures.
Very cool. So I know you guys do more than just that procedure, mm-hmm. which is incredible. What are some of the other things that you guys do?
So another common procedure we do is something called laser lithotripsy. Okay. Lithotripsy is just a medical term for we blow up stones.
Okay. Incredible.
And being a child of the 80s, one of my favorite video games was Asteroids mm-hmm. growing up, which mm-hmm. was basically flying a little ship and blowing up rocks with a laser. I'm excited that I get to take that into adulthood. And as an adult man, I get to basically play lifetime Asteroids. And what we do for stones predominantly that are in the bladder or in the urethra, traditionally that was always a surgery. We go in the abdomen, we open the abdomen, we then open the bladder, and we had to scoop and fish all these stones mm-hmm. out of the bladder. We then have to suture up the bladder, suture up the abdomen. And there's always a bit of potential for risks or complications with that procedure. Maybe we don't get all the stones out. One gets stuck somewhere. The bladder leaks or things afterwards. Sure. And then there's just the recovery time of right. that, right? We've got multiple incisions, usually at least a night in the hospital, plus 10 to 14 days of rest at home, no baths, watching, making sure
cone
the incision heals, cone of shame. So all those things that go with it. Now what we can offer in some cases is to go up the urethra with that endoscope into the bladder, identify those stones, and then we use a laser to fragment or break up those stones into really small pieces. Those small pieces then we can remove through the urethra. So similar, we talk about with the ectopic ureter, these are outpatient cases in general. So we go in, we anesthetize them, we break up all the stones, we take everything out, we wake them up, they go home the same day. You know, a little bit of irritation in the urethra the first 24 hours or so, we manage with some medications, but usually within 24, 48 hours, these dogs are back to fine again.
Wow.
And we have some of these dogs that get stones that, particularly male dogs, will get stones stuck in their urethra, particularly right around the area where there's a bone in the penis called mm-hmm. the os penis. And the stones like to get stuck just at the top part of that because that's where the urethra will narrow down to go through okay. the tunnel of the bone. Traditionally, sometimes we can flush the stones back to the bladder and then take them out through the bladder surgery. But we get some that are permanently lodged there and you can't get them free. And so the laser lithotripsy, if we can get the endoscope there, we then can use a laser, break that stone up and get it out through the urethra and not have to do a surgery where now we have to cut into the urethra itself to take that stone out.
Wow.
So that's a really fantastic way of dealing with stones in those areas. We're getting ready shortly here. I'm going to start offering a minimally invasive surgery to take stones directly out of the bladder. So not all dogs are good candidates for the laser lithotripsy if they have a ton of stones in their bladder, if they're all really large stones. If they're smaller male dogs, we can't even get the scope in mm-hmm. the urethra to get there. I'm going to start offering a procedure called a percutaneous cystolithotomy,
ooh,
or PCCL. It's a mouthful. Kind of a hybrid between doing that endoscopic procedure and doing the bladder surgery. So this will be a very small incision on the abdomen, very small incision in the bladder, and then we go straight into the bladder with the scope, where now we can use what we'll call a basket. It's a long device. It's got a little wire basket that deploys out. We basically wrap it around the stone, cinch it down so we can grab the stones, and then we can pull those out.
Wow.
And we pull it out through a port we put in the bladder, and so we can take a stone up to a centimeter out through that port. If we have stones that are bigger than that, we can, again, use the laser, break it up, but we don't have to break it into as small of pieces because we've got a bigger incision rather than bringing them out the urethra. And then we're able to use the scope, go into the bladder, go down into the urethra, and then we get a better idea for are we leaving any stones behind because we have this nice magnified view
wow.
on a big
mm-hmm.
screen. So we get a really great look at the inside of the bladder and the inside of the urethra so we make sure that all the stones are out of there.
And so since that's a smaller incision, is that an outpatient basis too?
A lot of times it can be an outpatient. And it's a fairly small incision, so a couple of sutures in it. We don't have to worry as much at home. We probably will have to, unfortunately, do the cone of shame mm-hmm. for some of these guys that are going to mm-hmm. lick at or at least keep it covered. But the recovery time is going to be a lot quicker because we don't have as big of incision to heal. It's not going to be as painful. So again, we're minimizing pain. We're minimizing time where they have to stay rested. We're minimizing some of the risk of leakage from the bladder
oh,
and
wow.
things. And so it'll be a nice in between where we can't do the lithotripsy procedure, but we don't necessarily want to do a full bladder surgery. And we have some of these dogs that are recurrent stone formers. And in the past, we've had to do recurrent bladder surgeries. Well, the more times you go in the abdomen like that, you start developing scar tissue, mm-hmm. and that can make it challenging. I've had surgeons where we've gotten to the point where the surgeon's telling me we can't do surgery anymore on this dog. It's just not safe to go into the abdomen. So this will be a nice procedure because we'll have a lot less risks.
Absolutely.
With those types of formation.
This is reminding me, so to put this into like people terms, and please correct me if I'm wrong, when I was 19, my appendix ruptured, and way back in the day, they used to have to do a full cut across your stomach and remove the appendix that way. I have three tiny little scars, mm-hmm. where they did it. I was still put under anesthesia and whatnot, but it was minimally invasive, and I don't even see them half the time. It's almost like it never happened. Is that the same kind of medicine?
Yeah, that's the same thing we would be talking about with this procedure, is a small little scar. It's going to be maybe centimeter and a half. So pretty small. So a centimeter is a little less than half an inch.
Wow. And you just have to, like, you're basically playing a video game.
Kind of, yeah. And we're going with the scope and just seek and destroy the asteroid. Much like the game.
When I first started at CVETS, I watched you do a laser lithotripsy, and the only thing that was missing was the pew pew noise.
Yeah, the laser does make a little bit of jackhammering noise, but yeah, someone needs to put a cooler noise box on that thing, because it would be nice if it, yeah, really sounded like a laser firing off from Star Wars or something, Star Trek.
It would make it like more entertaining.
Yeah, for sure. We do sometimes make the noise ourselves. So sometimes we are in there going pew, 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 pew.
Just to entertain ourselves.
Yes.
How long does a procedure like that take?
It's going to depend on the patient, really, how many stones they have and how big are the mm-hmm. stones. So, you know, a single 1 centimeter stone in a female dog, that might take 15, 20 minutes to blow up and take out.
Wow.
So it can be pretty quick. And that's what, you know, what's nice about, we're in, we're out, we wake them up, we send them home. If we have more stones, or if we're dealing with a male dog with bladder stones, it can take longer. It may take up to an hour, hour and a half with that. And that's where we try to pick and choose our candidates for that surgery. And if it's a procedure where I think it's going to take me a really long time with the procedure to get them out, or that I'm concerned that I may not even be able to get everything out, because after a while it just gets real cloudy in there and you lose track of stones and things like that, then those are patients where I'll usually recommend a different procedure. You know, even right now, if we're doing a traditional cystotomy, if they can open the bladder, take it out, mm-hmm. our surgeons are pretty quick with that. They can do that in maybe 30 minutes. So we're trying to do what's best for the patient. And while minimally invasive procedures are great, they're not always the best or ideal thing for every patient. So sometimes doing a more traditional surgery or other approach to it is ultimately what's best for the patient. So we're just going to evaluate each one.
And that goes back to your earlier note of your advice of you're always going to do what's best for the patient.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's awesome. And that's pretty cool too at CVETS, you know, having all the different specialties, you can kind of just say like, hey, I think this is the best course of action. Call down the hall mm-hmm. to, you know, Dr. Mike or someone to take over.
Yeah. Well, it's even great. Just sometimes it's just about having a conversation about it, you know, and we round about a patient and go, you know, this is what I can do. What can you offer? What can, you know, where do we think's best? And it's not about necessarily one person trying to make a decision about what's best for that patient. It's a group effort. You know, we all want to do what's best, and we're all back and forth. And, you know, as often as I go to the surgeon and go, listen, I've got this patient, they came in for the minimally invasive thing, but I really think the surgery is better. And we talk about it, they go, yeah, that sounds great. They take it. Just as often they come to me and go, hey, we have this patient that came here for a surgery, but we think it would be a good candidate for what you do minimally invasively. And, you know, so we chat back and forth about those patients. Some of this, you know, I mentioned replumbing patients, and there's a few different reasons we may get in a situation of needing to replumb, mm-hmm. you know, starting with ureter. So again, that's that tube that goes from the kidney to the bladder.
Right.
And one of the more common reasons we see that get obstructed is stones. Okay. So we talked about stones in the bladder, mm-hmm. But sometimes those stones don't form in the bladder. They actually start up in the kidney. And when those stones go to pass from the kidney to the bladder, they can block up the ureter. And if you've ever had, I know I've, probably TMI, but I've had kidney stones that have passed and had temporary obstruction, and a lot of other people have as well, or had at least a family member or friend.
Right,
so they're familiar with that for sure. And the same thing can happen in our patients. So that stone goes and it gets stuck somewhere in the ureter. And in dogs, one of the things we do when that happens is placement of what's called a ureteral stent. And in a lot of cases, we can do that endoscopically. So we're able to go up through the urethra. We then use some special what are called guide wires and catheters that allow us to access into the ureter. And then we place what's called a ureteral stent. And what this is kind of a long tube. It's made out of some special types of plastic. And it's flexible and soft. And the ends of the tube have a pigtail on it. So we call it a pigtail ureteral stent. And we place one end of that pigtail up in the kidney. It goes down through the ureter. And then the other end of the pigtail is in the bladder.
Okay.
And those pigtails help keep the stent from wanting to move back and forth in there. And what that does is open up the ureter, allows that urine to drain from the kidney to the bladder. It causes some passive dilation of that ureter. So now even if we had a stone that got stuck, sometimes that dilation then allows that stone to pass down into the bladder. And that's just what they do in people. So if you have a kidney stone that's stuck as a person, they're going to go in and put the stent in, see if it'll just pass.
Is that a permanent thing?
Usually we try not to leave them in permanently. Our goal is a temporary thing till we get that stone to move. And some of those stones that form may be due to an infection. If we treat the infection, the stone will dissolve and go away. Mm-hmm. And then once that stone's out of the ureter, there's no longer that ongoing obstruction. We can go in endoscopically and pull that ureteral stent back out. Long term, those stents can develop stone material on them. They can cause infections and things. So it's not ideal to leave them in long term. Sometimes we have situations where that's the case and we just have to periodically exchange the stent out. We can also use similar types of stents when we have cancer of the bladder wall, that is where those ureters enter in to the bladder.
Okay.
And so if that cancer is growing around that opening, it closes it off and the kidney becomes obstructed. And so we're able, a little bit different technique, we actually go in from the top across the skin directly into the kidney and pass those guide wires down and out and then put that stent in. And that again allows that urine to drain from the kidney to the bladder while then the cancer is being treated by our oncology group.
Wow.
We can have obstructions of the urethra. Sometimes that's due to stones. We already talked a little bit about that. And then we can go in with the laser and we can break those stones up. But we can also have cancer of the urethra. And if that cancer grows enough, it closes down the urethra. And we have a couple of techniques we can use for dealing with that. Sometimes we place what's called a urethral stent. So a little bit different type of stent than we talked about with the kidney. These types of stents are made out of wire, metal wire. And what I always describe to people, if you've ever seen chicken wire, if you took chicken wire and rolled it into a long tube, that's kind of what these stents look like. And they're self-expanding, which means they come compressed down on a delivery device. When you slide back the outer sheath, it expands and it wants to go out into a tube shape. So when you deploy that in the urethra, it pushes that tumor outward and compresses it against the urethral wall. So now the patient can urinate. And again, then we're doing chemotherapy to actually treat the cancer. But if they come in obstructed, we can do that. In some instances, we'll choose, rather than placing that stent, to use the laser, and we'll actually laser away some of that tumor tissue to open up the urethra.
Wow.
And the advantage of that is we can potentially go in there multiple times and laser that tissue away. And not all the bladder or the urethral cancers are amenable to that technique, so we just have to stent and treat. But it does give us another potential option for treating these guys and getting things open. Again, kind of replumbing. It's like having a clogged drain, and now we're going to go in there and do something to snake it out and get it open back up so that the urine can flow again.
With those kind of stents, the metal ones, are those permanent?
Those are permanent.
Okay.
Yep. Those stay in. Over time, tissue can potentially grow through them or the tumor can grow through them. Mm. So they're kind of a short-term help for us while we're treating and dealing with the tumor. Sometimes we'll use these stents for other causes of obstruction of the urethra, like strictures, so that scar tissue where we've had damage in the urethra. Mm. And now, if you've ever had a cut on your hand, sometimes you get a cut, it heals up, you never know you had it.
Right.
Other times when you get a deeper cut, you end up with a scar there. Same thing happens in other areas of the body. So in the urethra, if we get something that damages it, so maybe a stone that tried to pass got lodged temporarily, damaged the lining of that urethra all the way around, and then finally passed. Well, if that damage is bad enough, when it heals, it scars, and scar tissue contracts down.
So that causes what we call a stricture to form. So we have ways of dealing with that minimally invasively. Sometimes we'll just go in with this little balloon, goes across the stricture, and then we balloon and basically just stretch and break down that scar tissue to open things up. And sometimes that's enough, and they're good with that. Sometimes that stricture wants to keep recurring, and that's where we might go to a stent. And we have some various different types of stents. We have ones that are called covered stents. So they have a coating on the inside of them that helps prevent that scar tissue from just growing through the stent long term. So in those instances, sometimes we'll like to use a very special type of stent to try to reduce some of that risk. Or we have some temporary stents we might use in those situations that we can remove at a later date so they don't have to stay in the rest of that patient's life.
Gotcha. And that ballooning instance, I know that's the not the medical term for it, but that's a situation where you would use the fluoro. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. And a lot of these, a lot of these procedures. So fluoroscopy is lifetime x-rays. So I was explaining, you know, a typical x-ray is like taking a picture with your phone. Fluoroscopy is turning on your video camera. So you're watching in live time what exactly is happening under those x-rays going on. And we use that in a lot of our minimally invasive procedures. So the ureteral stenting I just mentioned, we're going to use it for that so we can visualize what's going on in the inside, where that guide wire is going, where the stent's going. We use it for our ectopic ureters sometimes. So sometimes we have to figure out where exactly is that ureter coursing to verify a diagnosis or to make sure that it's one that's safe to do the laser procedure to correct. Any of our urethral stenting, we're going to do that with. When we're trying to make a diagnosis of an obstruction in the urethra, we actually use it for diagnostic purposes. So we put a catheter in and we inject a contrast or dye agent that shows up on that fluoroscopy. And then we're able to see where is the area of problem.
Interesting.
And what's going on there. And then we decide, well, is that a mass or a tumor or a stricture? And then we figure out what's going to be the best tool to fix that obstruction, right? So just like the plumbers, well, maybe I'm going to get the plunger, maybe I'm going to get the snake out, maybe I have to cut some tubing out, you know? So that's the same thing for us. It's kind of figure out what's the nature of the obstruction. Then we can figure out, well, what's my best tool to fix that?
Gotcha. Wow. That's really cool. It's like a puzzle.
It is. Yeah. It's a fun puzzle. You know, and the best thing about these procedures is, you know, we take some of these dogs where they come in and they've not been able to pee. They've had to have a catheter in and stuff. You put a stent in, waking them up, and they're peeing just fine.
Wow. Yeah,
so it's okay. Pretty satisfying. You know, to everybody, part of me is a little bit of a surgeon heart. I'm always a little jealous about surgeons because you go to the surgeon and they do a surgery and they fix things, right? You have a broken bone, they put a plate or some pins or whatever in, and they're fixed. You've got a mass, they go in, they take it out.
Right.
You know, with medicine, a lot of what we do, it's like the GI stuff. Like we're tweaking with stuff and whatnot. We're never really fixing anything. We're just trying to treat it long term, you know. So there's very few things as an internist I like to just do and get some sort of instant gratification for the work that I've put in.
Yeah.
In these cases, there's only one of them. You take an animal that's obstructed, you go and you do this procedure, and they're instantly better.
That's awesome. That's really cool. You get the Tiger Woods, like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do something else you guys do in IM is you can actually put, I'm a type 1 diabetic, and it's so interesting to me to see that you guys put CGMs, continuous glucose monitors, on animals that they have diabetes. Can you tell me a little bit about diabetes in dogs?
Yeah, so that's something that's helped, I think, revolutionize our ability to manage diabetic pets, both cats and dogs, with it. And when I started in veterinary medicine 35 years ago, the main thing most of us were using were our in-hospital veterinary test machines. And to measure a blood sugar on that, you had to draw a pretty good volume of blood. And surely after that, we started using the point-of-care monitors that people have. You know, so they do the little prick of the finger, and you got the little test strips and things. And that was always kind of okay for us, but they're meant for people. You know, a lot of this technology, even the current CGMs, these continuous glucose monitors is what the CGM part stands for. They're meant for people. And so we always have to take it with a little bit of grain of salt what's happening with it. And we developed techniques for owners to do ear tip prick techniques or paw pad techniques for using those point of care monitors at home. Or we'd use them in the hospital and do these curves. But even at that, you know, we might be checking a blood sugar every couple of hours or 3 hours, and we're doing it for a limited time of the day. If we're doing a hospital, your average general practice might be open from 8 to 6. Mm-hmm. So you're not even getting a full 12 hours there. At home, if you're having an owner do it, you know, you might get to 12 hours, but people are going to be up all night. Although I have had clients that literally will stay up all night long or set an alarm, and every 2 hours they're getting up and doing that. God bless them. But your average owner, that, you know, that's not right. real feasible. And most of the time we're looking at one day. Okay. You're a diabetic, right? Is your glucose and how everything goes, is that the same every day?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not, right? And even though with our pets, and one of the things with diabetes I always stress to our owners is consistency, right? Because that is one thing compared to humans that we have a lot more control over. They're eating the same food. They're eating about the same time.
Right.
They probably have about the same level of activity day to day. But even in those best circumstances, things are different day to day with how things go. And where the continuous glucose monitors have come in, these CGMs, and the main one we use is the one by Abbott called the Libre system. And I'm not trying to push one system over the other.
Not sponsored.
It's just what most of us use and we have the most data on right now. And what it's done is allow us, now we don't have to poke and prod the patients all the time. And we put this little sensor on and we're continuously getting this data. And these systems now read every few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, they're collecting sample and they're storing it. And we don't have to do anything. We don't have to be there. It's doing it 24 hours a day for theoretically 14 days, 15 days, how these sensors are supposed to last. Oftentimes sensors, especially in our pets, because they're not meant to be on dog skin or cat skin. And so we do have some challenges keeping them on. Sometimes they take them off on their own, which your average person probably is not doing either. But they give us this wealth of information. We can get a better idea what's happening day to day. We can see when that patient ate or when they got their insulin and how has that affected that patient. And it allows us to zero in a little bit better on how do we go about managing that pet's diabetes to meet our goals. You know, and unlike people where they want you to be in a very specific range, essentially 24/7. That's not a very realistic goal most of the time for us. And so instead, we're using this Libre data to figure out, well, how do we get in the ballpark where we have a pet who's pretty reasonably controlled? They're not at high risk for some of the major complications of diabetes. And everybody's quality of life is good. Right. The pet's quality of life, the owner's quality of life. And that's really the goals we're meeting. You're not trying to be in a specific range or hit specific numbers, but really just try to make everybody's quality of life good and figure out what we can do. And so one of those CGMs is a minimally invasive way for monitoring them. I always tell people it's a little bit of a love-hate. When they're working great and we're getting good data on them, I absolutely love them. When they're problematic, they're problematic. The newer Libre 3 system is a smaller sensor. It's only about the size of a quarter. And I feel like since we've gone to those smaller sensors, I feel like they're staying on better. Mm-hmm. I think there's just less wobble with it, I think, is why they're better. I don't really know. But they seem to stay on better. And we're getting a lot more out to 14 days versus some of these. And I've had pets where the sensor lasts for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And they're calling us going, hey, they took it off for things. So, yeah, but that's certainly made a huge difference in the data we're collecting, and not just for treating patients, but a lot of people are doing diabetes research. It's really helped them understand when new insulins come out or around, you know, especially on the human side. And that's, you know, we take this new insulin came out of people. Let's see what happens in a cat or a dog. And it's helped us generate a lot of good data to figure out, is this an insulin that might be better or helpful for our pets?
That's awesome. Technology helping us
every
day. All right. Well, let's get into some lighter stuff. What is the most memorable experience you've had as a veterinarian?
I'd say it's not per se a specific instance. For me right now, the most memorable thing is the first cat I saw through treating for FIP with the new small molecule antiviral drugs.
What is...
And to go back in history, so again, I started in the veterinary field 35 years ago, and FIP is called feline infectious peritonitis. That's a coronavirus, and we all know about coronaviruses, unfortunately, thanks to COVID, right? And this starts as an enteric coronavirus, enteric meaning the GI tract. And a lot of cats get exposed to this as kittens from their mother or other litter mates and things. And in most cats, it's not a big deal. They have it. They might have a little bit of diarrhea for a few days. It goes away. They're fine. In a small percentage of cats, for reasons we're still trying to sort out, that enteric coronavirus undergoes a mutation into the FIP virus. And this FIP virus is a much more, for a better term, malignant virus. And most of what we see clinical sign with it is actually the immune system's reaction to the virus being there rather than the virus itself. And most notably, when we think about FIP, we think about these cats that develop big effusions in their abdomen or in their chest. They may turn yellow or icteric from their bilirubin levels going up. They can have neurologic disease with it. It most often affects cats under 2 or 3 years of age, most commonly, a lot of times kittens. And while this disease has been known about for probably over 40 years now, it's essentially been a death sentence. Almost 100% of cats with FIP would die from FIP, regardless of what we did in the past. And a lot of people have been chasing this disease for years and years and years, trying to find something that would work for it. And before COVID-19 actually hit, there was these what are called small molecule drugs. They're a newer class of drugs, and they work by inhibiting viral replication in action in the body. And the group at UC Davis, Dr. Neil Peterson, who'd been spent most of his career studying FIP, and you know, his goal was before he retired to find a cure or a treatment for FIP. And shortly before his retirement, he finally did this. He worked with a company that was developing one of these drugs. Actually, I think to treat Ebola virus was originally what the company was looking into it on the human side. And they provided some of this drug to Dr. Peterson at UC Davis, and he did the initial study showing that he basically cured most of the cats that had FIP. And that started, you know, people going, oh, this is great. The problem was getting the drug. And the last few years, that became a little bit almost of a black market situation to get it in the U.S. We had these grassroots organizations that were getting the drug and getting it in through different sources and then basically delving it out to people. We would identify cats with FIP. We'd be like, hey, contact this group. We've now in the last, I guess it's been maybe a year and a half, maybe a little longer now, we've got a couple of our national compounding pharmacies in the U.S. now that have gotten clearance from the FDA to actually import legally drug that we know is the right stuff. And be able to compound in formulations for us to treat these cats. And literally, we see these cats that are literally almost on death door, and you start them on treatment, and a lot of them within 48 hours are almost back to normal with it. And so when we talk about memorable experiences and having been through this the last 35 years and watched a lot of cats die or euthanized a lot of cats for this disease, to now have something where we've gone from almost 100% death rate to about an 85% successful treatment in the last couple of years. And so for me, you know, that'll probably go down as one of the biggest things I've seen. You know, I'm always excited about the interventional stuff, and me and colleagues have come a long way doing a lot of that and been there on the kind of the forefront and done a lot of those procedures, and it's great to see that. But I think that just over my career and seeing and having lost so many cats to that disease, to see us finally have a treatment, not 100% yet, but 85%, I'll absolutely take over 100% death. So that's probably the most memorable thing for me.
Wow, that's incredible. I can't imagine spending all those years, you know, not being able to do anything, and now all of a sudden you can. That's really cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool. What's the wildest thing that's ever happened to you? Just like crazy, what just happened?
As an intern, so we're talking about life in general.
veterinary field.
Wildest thing, I think it was actually not long before I left University of Florida. I used to do a lot of work with we had a wildlife service there and zoo service. And so they would see all the crazy critters, right? And a lot of times they would call on us for various different endoscopy services or sometimes for minimally invasive things. And did a lot of work with them. And, you know, I never knew what they were, you know, come to. And, you know, we'd done lions and tigers and manatees and things like that. And one day, one of our wildlife folks stopped me in the hallway and they said, oh, hey, you know, we've got the zoo. They've got this king cobra that we need to scope. Would you be willing to do it? And I was like, well, you know, sure, you know, whatever. And he's like, really? And I was like, well, yeah, like, have I ever turned you guys down? You know, like, we're always happy to help. And it's always kind of a cool thing for us. You know, yeah. I mean, love cats and dogs, but to get to something do something different. Wild and exotic is always fun. And he's like, okay, well, you know, I'll start getting things set up. And, you know, I didn't hear from him for a couple of weeks. And he saw me in the hallway again. He's like, you know, I just want to check. Are you still okay with doing this? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, I know. I'm like, he's like, you know, it's a king cobra. I was like, okay, yeah, you know, I've done a lot of exotic things, big things, things that can kill you. But, you know, wildlife zoo people, they're great. They work with these animals all the time. They know how to do it safely, you know, and they've never put me in harm's way. So, like, I maybe wrongly, but I put my full life in trust of them. So, no big deal. And so then we start getting things set up and we're within a week and he sees me again. He's like, you know, so you're still good. And I was like, yeah, yeah. But, you know, at this point I'm like, why is Daryl asking me so often if I'm still good with this? So it's starting to now make me think nervous. If I should be a little nervous about this. Right. And he's like, okay. Well, you know, not a big deal. You know, we'll let UF Shands, which is was our human teaching hospital across the street. Like, you know, we'll make sure they're on, you know, standby and that, you know, they've got antivenin on hand, you know, in case anybody gets bit or anything. I'm like, okay. And so then we get to the day of doing this. And they, you know, manage snake initially and get, you know, it gets transported from the zoo. It's coming from to us. And we've got a room in our large animal area set up that we can basically lock the door. So, you know, if mm-hmm. anything happened, you know, no one's walking in on a king cobra running around or anything crazy, right?
Running around.
But, they, you know, and again, the people who do this stuff, they're very professional. They've got this down. They do this all the time, right? So they're doing their thing. They get it moved to basically a large container that they can apply a gas anesthetic to and anesthetize. Okay. So that way no one's handling it awake for safety reasons, right? So they call me when they're starting that process. So I go down there and they get it and we get everything going. And, you know, we've got an anesthesia crew there and the wildlife crew and the zoo crew, you know, and everyone's working on it. And I'm just standing back because I don't want to be in the way. And I also don't want to be the first person to get bit if things aren't going right. Yeah. And so they get everything out. We get it. We get the breathing tube in it. They've got it all checked and stuff. And anybody who's worked with reptiles, the hard thing about reptiles is you never truly know if they're anesthetized. Or not. It's not like a cat or a dog. They can be very, very still for very long periods with really slow heart rates and things. So sometimes it's hard to tell are they truly anesthetized or not. So they have some safety things. They've got this like glass tube that goes over the head, right? So it covers the head so that they've got control of it. So if it does wake up, it can't, you know, bite or get anything. But you know, part of this is they want me to do an endoscopy on it down its GI tract. So well, that GI tract starts in the mouth, right?
Okay.
So asleep, not asleep, in a glass tube or not, our hands are going in where the fangs and the venom and stuff are, right? So we get all set up and we're getting ready to start. And at that point, one of the nurses gets a call on her phone and she's like, uh-huh. And she's like, so it's off. She goes, Dr. Hurd, they want to know if we still need to keep the ambulance on hold outside or if they can go back into circulation. And that's when it really hit me. I'm like, okay, like
what?
I know he said
did
we have some anti-venin and stuff like that, but yeah, they had, you know, just because of the nature of what we're dealing with, and all I find this out about now is like if you get bit by, I'm thinking, you know, people get bit by snakes, you get taken to the hospital, you get anti-venin, they do treatment and stuff. I didn't, because I don't know that much about king cobras, but apparently their venom's bad enough that you don't have a whole lot of time to get to the hospital.
No.
So they had this whole chain of people on. They
just
had an ambulance waiting. They had apparently one of the bays in the emergency room was held off in case anybody got bit to be immediately shuffled over there and immediately into that bay where they had the antivenin waiting stuff. So you know, the human hospital is calling us going, where are you guys at? Do we still need to keep these resources on hold for you and things like that?
And you're just
I'm like, what did I get into, you know? And then, you know, we lay out the snake, you know, and I'm thinking, you know, a snake, you know, or a snake or a snake. No, this thing, they measured, I can't remember now, it was somewhere between like 12 to 15 feet long.
Oh.
Cobra. Yeah, we had to put a couple of tables together to run it out long enough and curl it up.
Fit down there.
Well, so then this, you know, and as I start doing this, I don't know if you remember the scene from Jaws, and Sheriff Brody, he's like chumming out, you know, whatever, and Jaws pops up out of the water, right? And he turns and he's like, I think we're going to need a bigger boat.
Yes.
This is where I went to put the scope down. I was like, I think we're going to need a longer scope. And we ended up having to borrow one of our equine large animal scopes that is a 3-meter scope. So about almost 10-foot scope we ended up needing just to get down to the stomach on the snake. Because the scope I have, it's about I think I had the 1.5-meter scope. We could only get about halfway down. And even with the 3-meter scope, we only made it to the stomach
on
the snake. We couldn't get, you know, which is where we needed to get to, so we were good. But
right.
Yeah.
Did anyone get bit?
No. Everybody was good. Everybody was safe. They got it. And again, you know, those guys, they're a phenomenal crew down there. And like I said, I always just blindly go into these things with no fear.
Whatever,
because
it's all good.
They've always got everything, you know, under control. And so I've never felt like my life was in danger. But that was the first time I turned to Daryl. I was like,
ambulance?
Yeah. Now I understand why you kept asking if I was okay with this, because apparently I just wasn't smart enough to know how scared I should be.
To really take in
about
all
this.
Of the...
Yeah.
Wow. Well, with that being said, my last question is, it sounds like you've done some pretty cool creatures. So if there was an animal, a wild animal that you could examine that you haven't yet, what would be your dream animal?
What I came really close to being able to do this, but would be to work on a dolphin.
Ooh.
That's one of the cool species I've not had a chance to get hands on. I came very close a number of years ago. I had a zoo vet down in South Florida contacted me. One of the things they see with dolphins in captivity, at least, is that they get stoned. So we talked about stones in the bladder and urethra and stuff. So they had a dolphin that was having some stone issues and things, and they were looking to see, was there something minimally invasive we could do? So we had actually contacted one of my colleagues at University of Florida. So we have an aquatic animal medicine program there that's separate from our wildlife and zoo program. They just do aquatic animal medicine, which includes dolphins, sea turtles, all those cool things. One of my colleagues there had put this vet who contacted him in with me, and we were trying to figure out the logistics of moving equipment and getting equipment down to where the dolphin, because bringing the dolphin all the way up to us wasn't going to be as easy to do is seeing, could we move all the equipment down there? But then there's some challenges with anatomy in the dolphin and the urethra and things like that. So we talked about some things, went back and forth, and then ultimately ended up not doing it. So I was very close. I was so close. I was very sad. But if that opportunity came up, I'd love to get a chance to go and do some stuff with the dolphins.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
this has been really educational and really informative, and we appreciate you coming on our podcast.
Yeah, well, thank you, Emily.
Absolutely. Well, until next time, give your pets an extra pet from us, and thank you for tuning in to Soda City Unleashed.